Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them. It's the show where we tell stories about the things that divide us. I'm Trey Kay.
In 3.2 miles, take exit 191 to merge onto I-64 west toward Lexington.
I'm on the road between New York and West Virginia. I make this drive a lot, and every time I feel like I'm moving in between two worlds. From my adopted home of my adult life to my childhood home. From the big city in the Northeast to the Appalachians. And people who've made this trip with me say that as I drive south, my accent changes.
Take the exit.
Right now I'm on Interstate 64, headed for the border between Virginia and West Virginia. And this state line is like no other in the country. West Virginia is the only state that was carved out of another state during the Civil War. When Virginia seceded from the Union, some of the counties in the western part of the state split off, and they stayed with the Union, and now that's what is West Virginia.
Turn left onto North Main Street.
But not everyone in the new state was on the same page. There were divided loyalties. Men from West Virginia fought for both sides during the Civil War. Some people say West Virginia is the most northern state in the South. Others say it's the most southern state in the North. So I come by this us and them stuff honestly. My people live on a political divide. We've been reaching out a hand to both sides for generations. It's in our DNA. And maybe that's why I'm drawn to places where cultures bump up against each other and people are struggling to talk across the divide. I actually go looking for them. And that's why I'm stopping here in Virginia. We'll come back to that later. I'll tell you more about that at the end of the show. But first, I want to tell you about a different trip that I took recently. On this trip, I didn't go looking for a political divide. I just stumbled across it.
So I'm walking over the old bridge or the ancient bridge here in Skopje.
That's me walking around the capital of North Macedonia. The city's called Skopje. North Macedonia is in southeastern Europe. It used to be part of Yugoslavia. So I'm in Skopje, and I'm walking across a river on a stone bridge that was built in the 1400s.
And on one side, you see a statue of Philip II. And he has his fist, his right fist in the air, and he's looking across the river to the other side, which has this huge statue of Alexander the Great. The great conqueror, and that statue, it's about as high as most of the buildings here in Skopje.
I'm 5,000 miles away from home. I'm walking across a 500-year-old bridge. It feels old world and exotic, but I'm looking at these huge statues of military heroes, and I'm thinking, wait a minute. This feels a lot like home. The city of Skopje has lots and lots of statues.
In 2010, the government that was in power decided that the city needed a more classical feel. Part of the project was to build monuments, dozens of them. And the more that I looked at these statues, the more I thought some of these remind me of Confederate monuments back in the States. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me give you a little bit of background.
I need to get my mic over here. Okay, can you see me?
Yeah.
And for that, I want to bring in my son Templeton. Templeton's the reason I was in Skopje. He was living there for a college internship, and he's been studying North Macedonia pretty intensely. So I asked him to sit in the studio with me and help me make sense of what I saw when I was visiting.
You know, North Macedonia is a beautiful place that is currently undergoing a lot of turbulence. It's a multi-ethnic society. It's got large numbers of ethnic Albanians, a majority ethnic Macedonian. It's got Roma. It's got people of Turkish descent. And it's got Vlachs.
Vlachs?
Yeah, the Vlachs are their ethnic group.
But so there's just this huge confluence of people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a small city, so everyone's got to, you know, interact with people of different faiths. And one of the things I really love about Skopje is you can feel like you're moving between different worlds,
yeah.
Taking about 10 steps.
Skopje was the first city I'd visited, where I heard the Muslim call to prayer in the streets. But there were also Orthodox churches everywhere. And Skopje is the hometown of the Catholic saint, Mother Teresa. But let's get back to the city statues. I asked Templeton into the studio because I needed to understand the statues I saw from the bridge. And first, the 50-foot tall guy with his fist in the air, who's standing on a 50-foot pedestal.
That statue is supposed to symbolize Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great.
It's a pretty impressive statue.
It's giant, and I expect it's not actually bronze, but it's supposed to look, you know, like a real valuable metal. he's looking across the river, and he's looking over. I think the idea is that he's fist bumping to this other statue across the river that is, again, very controversial. It was a real sticking point with the Greeks for a while.
What is that statue?
Well, the official name would be Warrior on Horse, but it's fairly strongly identified as, you know, Alexander the Great sitting on his horse. So all the statues in the main square are all various figures that are related to the ancient kingdom of Macedon. What some other folks might say are in Greek history, but of course that's a disputed history in North Macedonia.
So the Greeks basically say, hey, these aren't your guys, these are our guys.
Yeah.
You know that I've done a good bit of reporting here in the United States about the statues that we have going back to the American Civil War. And that war ended, you know, more than 150 years ago, and still there seems to be a lot of tension. Do you see any similarities to, like, the statues in that area and how people feel about them?
How you feel about the statues in Skopje is probably very indicative of where you are politically there. You know, the people who look fondly upon the statues are probably fond of the previous government who built them. The people who don't like the statues are probably fond of the current government.
On the left, you have the Turkish bath.
When I was in Skopje, I spent part of a day with Arsim Zakoli.
Right next to it, you see the church, the Orthodox Church.
He's a historian and former North Macedonian ambassador. Now he's a political commentator.
And in between them, you see the statues of Philip II and Alexander the Great.
He says Alexander the Great has gotten all tangled up in the identity politics of the region. And here in the Balkans, identity politics go back a long, long time.
The identitarian policy is something new.
The what?
Identitarian policy.
Identitarian.
Yes. It's something new in the United States. But it's the basics of politics in the Balkans. From the beginning, the whole Balkan saga was the use of the Balkans as a border point between the East and the West.
Arsim says you can actually see the East and the West meeting. There's a place a few miles outside of Skopje that people call the Stone River. It's kind of like Europe's Mason-Dixon line.
And if you visit the site, you will see that there is something like a river of stones. But that was a wall that existed as a demarcation point between the Eastern and Western Roman Empire. And it was passing right through to this area. There's a saying among Macedonians, the West does not like us, and the East does not register us, does not take account of us. And hence this existence in a limbo between two major civilizations.
And this meeting of the East and West brings us back to that huge controversial statue of Alexander in Skopje.
So, Alexander the Great is the symbolism of this duality.
Arsim says Alexander the Great is a symbol of this East-West duality in Macedonia because people on both sides claim him. So I went back to the central square in Skopje to talk with people about the warrior on the horse statue. It didn't take long to get a sense of the division Arsim was talking about.
Who is that?
Alexander the Great.
I met a woman in her 20s named Daniela.
Is he a hero? Is he your hero?
Not really.
Why?
Well, because I'm kind of peaceful and he was a war guy. I'm not into war. I'm more into Mother Teresa stuff. So not my hero, but for our nation, yeah. That's why he's like on the square.
What do you think of him being on the square?
It's okay for me. It's part of history, so it's okay.
There was controversy when they put the statue up. That's what I understand. Okay. How did you feel about that?
It's part of the culture. I don't see it like controversial. So for me, there is no problem.
You just had an election. Let's say the new government says, you know what, we don't like the statue. We're going to take it down. We'll take it down next month. How would you feel about that?
For me, that's not good because why? Like, it's already here. Why to take it down, you know?
But
it's already, like, built. Why to take it down?
I mean, I've been here a couple of days. I've seen Macedonians, I've seen Albanians, I've seen Christians, I've seen Muslims. And does he represent all of those people?
Well, as far as I know, Alexander, he has like one idea to build one community, one language, one people. I think that here in Macedonia, most of the Macedonians like Alexander the Great, not Albanians, not other. So maybe the answer is no. He's not representative of all the people here.
I also talked with a young man named Angel.
So I have what might seem like a dumb question.
Okay.
Okay. There's a statue right there in front of us here in this square. Who is that?
Alexander the Great.
Who is he?
He was... It's complicated. Was he Greek or Macedonian? I don't really care. He lived actually in the South Macedonia towards Greece, and he conquered a lot of Asia.
So the way you speak of him, it sounds like he's a hero.
Well, he's not a hero. He conquered. I can't consider somebody a hero who took something that didn't belong to him. I don't consider him my hero. He's just somebody who wanted to rule the world.
How do you feel about this statue being here?
I think it's something that shouldn't be here.
Why?
The square was nice before they redid this. Like this building, that one, this one over here. they were all different, and they were nice. They were part of Macedonian history.
What I get from that is that we have a statue here, and yeah, statues across the river of Philip that are of Greek culture. And it looks as though with a lot of these buildings here, they seem to have like Hellenic facades on them. But it seems to me that you're saying that's not your history.
Yeah. The people don't want this, actually. Everybody I know, like, I opened Facebook after they posted about this changes when the project was announced, and everybody was posting pictures of olden times, like how it was. People still miss it, the way the old square was.
While I was on the streets of Skopje talking with folks about the statues, I got a surprise. I saw a guy wearing a bright gold t-shirt with a flying WV. That's the logo of the West Virginia University Mountaineers. In West Virginia, you see it everywhere. But seeing it in North Macedonia was kind of like finding a four-leaf clover. So who are you?
My name is Kyle, WVU class of 2007.
What are you doing in Skopje?
I just took some vacation from work. I work over in the D.C. area. I'm in banking. And I just rented a car and thought, the hell with it, man. Let's just drive around, see what's going on.
And where are you from in West Virginia?
I was born and raised in Parkersburg.
So I have a question for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So come over here. Okay, so look far over there.
All right.
You see a statue. There's a guy who's on a horse. Do you know who that is?
I believe it's Alexander the Great, but we're not supposed to say that.
Why?
Well, as I understand it, there's a bit of a tiff between Greece and the newly named North Macedonia over who has the rights to some of these cultural figures. So now it's just warrior on horse. It's no longer Alexander the Great.
And we're standing under another statue. Who's that?
That one I don't know.
Okay, well, that I know.
Okay.
That is Philip II.
Ah, Philip II of Macedon. Okay, another one. Yep.
And he's looking across the river to his son.
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right, well, that explains it.
So you know of the controversy that
I have followed it in the news, because I was in Athens already, and I got to hear their side.
What's their side?
Oh, their side is, this country's full of crap. They're Slavic. They have no connection to Greek peoples of ancient Macedonia, and they are culturally appropriating all these figures and have no claim to it. So that's sort of their side, and they feel very strongly about it.
And just out of curiosity, do you think that there's any relationship to this, to some of the controversies that we have in America over statues and monuments?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, for me, it's a part of history. I don't see it as anything to get all huffy about. You know, and if that's us taking down a Robert E. Lee statue in Virginia, I personally think, look, he was a guy. He was an American who fought for what he believed in at the time. I don't see any reason that it should be taken down based on something that happened in 1863. So that's my personal opinion. I don't see the problem with it.
Coming up, we'll go to a cemetery with an old friend of mine who loves symbols of the Confederacy, including the Confederate battle flag.
It's a beautiful flag.
I'm Trey Kay, and you're listening to Us and Them from West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX. This show is funded in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation.
In difficult times, music gives us peace, brings us together, and helps heal us. It calms our nerves and brightens our days. That's why we're bringing you classic episodes of Mountain Stage on air and in our podcast. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find something that's familiar or brand new and feel the power of live music on our website, mountainstage.org.
You're listening to Us and Them. I'm Trey Kay. So where are we right now?
Well, we're in the oldest cemetery in Corinth, and where several Confederate soldiers are buried. It started, 1842, is that what it was?
Let's go read the sign again. Okay. That's me with my friend Alice Moore. She lives in Tennessee near the Mississippi border.
A while ago, we drove down to Corinth, Mississippi. She wanted to show me their city cemetery.
City cemetery. Earliest evidence of Corinth's settlement. Oldest cemetery in the city, with the first burial dated at 1842.
So describe to me what we're seeing here in the cemetery.
Well, you come in the gate here, there you see a Confederate flag right there. And they're scattered all over the cemetery.
What do you feel like when you see the flag here in the cemetery?
I love the flag. I love what it represents. I love the fact that it was the flag of people who stood up and fought for what ended up being a losing cause, but they believed in what they were doing. They knew they were in a minority, but they fought a tremendous battle. That flag represents standing up for what's right and just and fighting for what you believe in.
Do you understand that the Confederate battle flag, to many people in this country, it's a symbol that is akin to the swastika, and that it's very difficult for them to see it any other way?
Well, are you concerned, or does it bother you that there are people in this country who see that flag as representing their ancestors and a war that was fought against unbelievable odds and fought so bravely and gallantly, and people suffered horribly in the South? And I don't think the United States has ever treated a country like the South was treated after the war. People literally were starving to death in the South. And that flag represents their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers and memories of their families. I had a friend visiting down one time who said to me, I just don't understand why people want to keep fighting that war, the Civil War, over and over, why they still feel so strongly about that war. Well, it's because we were invaded. Our country was invaded, and our country was destroyed.
For a long time, I've tried to understand why some Southerners, nice people, people I like, people like Alice, why they have such deep affection for the flag. She says it's too bad that some races have taken over the flag as their symbol, because that's not what the flag means to her. When I listen to her, I realize it's not just that she and I have different senses of the flag. We believe in different versions of American history. Even when we read the same facts, we hear a different story.
So it's unfair to you that this icon, the flag, continues to be associated with slavery.
Well, what can I do about that? It's just inaccurate education. The pictures write the textbooks too, obviously. The slaves, for the most part, lived better lives, in a sense, as far as their needs being met, and food and clothing. And the slaves were often far better off than poor Southerners.
You do realize that there are a lot of people who would disagree. Okay, I understand you're not defending slavery, but I do feel that there would be a lot of people who would respectfully disagree with your assessment. It seems as though you're giving a very broad assessment of how all slaves were treated in the South, and I think that there is a record that basically speaks against what you just said.
Well, I can tell you this. I can show you some old reports of things that, you know, are on the internet now, records, old records and things, that about some of the wealthy black slave owners in the South. I went to the museum where they had all these, you know, very prominent looking black families. They had their own social life, and they're finely dressed people, obviously very prosperous people.
I checked this out, and historians say there's truth in what Alice is saying about some black people owning slaves. But it's complicated. We'll put the question to a historian later in the show.
So it wasn't this black-white hatred thing. There were even some white slaves who would sell themselves into slavery for, you know, to get passage to America
or something. Slavery is not a racial thing.
I don't think it was a racial thing per se, because blacks had slaves, and when they would they did.
Alice, I hear that.
But I'm just telling you the facts.
What you're doing is you are reaching in and you're finding some very like a little chestnut of an idea that you're holding out there, and you're saying, doesn't this change everything?
No, it doesn't change everything.
It doesn't change everything.
I mean, I just want you to understand, this is not a one-sided issue here. People in the South didn't hate each other. Black people and white people didn't hate each other. We had a separated society to a great extent, but you didn't have hatred down here. This is the heart of a country where people believe the Bible is the word of God, and they don't believe in treating other people in evil and cruel ways.
It was really cold in the cemetery, so Alice and I had to get back into the car to warm up. Let's just, for sake of discussion, say that in a way you have just set the record straight. But I still look around here and I see these Confederate battle flags here in the cemetery. And if it wasn't for the horrors of Reconstruction and the really darkened days of the Jim Crow South, that in many ways rallied under that flag, I would say, yeah, okay, the battle flag, it's a sign of Southern pride. But it's also wrapped up in that part of the ugly part of segregation and Jim Crow, and I don't know how you extricate that.
Well, do you believe that people who love that as a symbol of the South shouldn't be allowed to have it? We should pass a law making it illegal for people to love their heritage, love their relatives, take great pride in the bravery of these people and the stand that they took for what they believed was right. And that flag represents that to all of these people. And you're saying, well, there are people who see it otherwise, therefore it's an evil thing, we ought to do away with it. Why?
So what, we need to go back because I'm getting tired. I just want to say one thing before we leave the cemetery. First of all, thank you for bringing me here.
Oh, I'm so glad to bring you out here.
And the sun is setting here right now, and actually the light looks like really, really lovely here on the cemetery. I mean, just what are your final thoughts as we're pulling away?
How peaceful it is. I love old cemeteries. I love walking around and reading the tombstones, and just, there's so much history in them. And I just love this one in particular because it's small and, you know, encased in a brick wall like this, and it just tells a story. It just is representative of this section of the country, I think.
Well, it's interesting that y'all did the interview in Corinth.
That's Ed Baptist.
I'm a professor of history at Cornell University, and I teach a number of courses, including the history of the Civil War. This part of northern Mississippi had just been opened up to cotton settlement in the late 1840s, early 1850s. It was a frontier. It was the place where the most well-capitalized, most entrepreneurial planters brought enslaved people, droves of enslaved people, many of whom they'd recently bought in the domestic slave trade, and forced them to cut down the trees and create massive cotton fields. And for those who survived slavery in northern Mississippi, those people remembered northern Mississippi and these other frontier areas as basically hell on earth. The interviews with formerly enslaved people bear that out.
I wanted to talk with Professor Baptist to see if there was any truth in Alice's version of history. And he says there is. For example, it's true that the North and Britain gained huge financial benefits from slave labor and the cotton trade. And it's true that black people owned slaves, but there's more to that.
You can find some isolated cases of people of African descent who owned slaves in the South in 1860. For the most part, these are people who had bought their relatives in order to keep their relatives from being sold away or some other sort of trauma. A lot of free black people were married to enslaved spouses. And certainly they almost all of them had relatives who were still enslaved. And in many southern states as of 1860, it was legally impossible for a free African-American to carry it out.
Professor Baptist grew up in North Carolina. He knows people who share Alice's idea that slavery was more benign than what's depicted in history books. More like Gone with the Wind than 12 Years a Slave.
I'm related to a lot of people who hold those kinds of views. I grew up around a lot of people like that. I had white teachers who held those kinds of views. I had white teachers who had different kinds of views, and I had African-American teachers who had very different views about the history. And I understand that it's difficult to look back and say, you know, my ancestors were on the wrong side of history. It's very difficult because it makes you feel like you are wrong and you are a bad person. But unfortunately, it's just a truth that has to be faced. And let me put it this way. Somebody like Alice is not – I'm not saying she's a bad person. And she's probably better than me, right? But
she's a good person, I think.
But I think she would find a sense of liberation, a sense of freedom if she could let go of the desire to claim against all the evidence that her ancestors – were on the right side of history. And the ancestors, I'm not saying that they were bad through and through, although I'm pretty sure that being an enslaver did some pretty horrific things to your soul and to your psyche. But there may still have been people who were not bad through and through who participated in that process. But they did bad things and they participated in a bad system. And there's just no way around that.
What do you think of people like Alice and their expression of love for the Confederate battle flag?
The polls I've seen suggest that over 70% of white South Carolinians supported keeping the flag on the State House grounds. Why is it so important to them? The flag was important during the Civil War, but it became important again after, in particular, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. It started to be used more and more widely as a sort of a rallying emblem for the folks who wanted to defeat what they saw as the rising tide of desegregation and the destruction of Jim Crow and Southern life. Over time, that flag has come to symbolize the resistance of white Southerners to sharing power with African Americans. So there may be formal desegregation, but that doesn't mean that there's actually going to be any rectification of the numerous iniquities that we find in Southern and, you know, American life in general, iniquities that are inflicted on African Americans all the time. It's a symbol of that. When it was being moved from the State House dome to its new site on the State House grounds, in fact, supporters of the flag chanted, "Off the dome and in your face." So it's a giant middle finger to African Americans. To people like Alice, it doesn't necessarily mean that, but it does mean a sense of nostalgia for times that seemed perhaps less troubled, where there seemed to be less conflict and less criticism of, for some people like that, their very sense of identity.
Clearly, you have a different way of viewing the South than and the history of the South than my friend Alice. And there are probably going to be people who are going to listen to this podcast who are going to think that I'm wrong for putting someone on who has a view that says that slavery wasn't so bad or that the Confederate flag stands for honor. And do you think that I'm wrong for letting her articulate that point of view? Is that a point of view that you feel that America needs to hear?
Well, I think you have to bring these ideas out into the light. And I think you have to show that people who believe those things exist, and they seem like, and in some ways they are very nice people. And I hope that what that will do is get some listeners to think about their own ideas and their own beliefs. I don't think she's a villain. I think her ideas about her identity are profoundly wrong and limiting. I hope that in the future more people will be able to free themselves from those ideas. But we can only do it by talking about that fact. We can't just simply stop talking about race, stop talking about history, stop talking about the persistence of racism in various guises. We've got to talk about it.
I was an find a land of cotton. Old times are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland.
The Confederate flag isn't the only enduring symbol of the Old South. How about this song? You've heard it on TV and in movies and cartoons, and you may have even heard people whistling the tune. A few years ago, I did a story about the song Dixie for the public radio show Studio 360. Here it is. On April 4th, 1859, while the clouds of war were gathering in America, Bryant's minstrel show, performing at a Broadway theater in New York City, was about to inject one of the most memorable and ultimately most controversial songs into the nation's bloodstream.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is now my pleasure to present a new ballad written by Mr. Tambo, and I must say, against the advice of his friends. It is entitled Dixie.
This scene, from a 1943 film called Dixie, starring Bing Crosby, tries to recreate the song's debut.
I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times are not forgotten. Look away.
Did you catch that? When Crosby, who is in blackface, sings old times dar am not forgotten, he's imitating a slave dialect, as written by a white man from Ohio.
It's a white person dressed as a black person longing for the plantation South.
That's Coleman Hutchison, professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He devotes a lot of ink to Dixie in his book, Apples of Ashes, Literature, Nationalism, and the Confederate States of America.
The idea is that this person who's singing is away from Dixie, which we understand to be somewhere in the South, and that the person is really crying out to be back there, wishing that they could be back, nostalgically wishing they could be back on the plantation, away, way, way down south in Dixie.
This is why many people have always regarded Dixie as racist. With its happy depiction of plantation life, it seems to apologize for slavery. We can't say precisely who wrote Dixie. Daniel Decatur Emmett, a white minstrel songwriter, most often gets the credit. But Coleman Hutchison and other scholars think that he might have lifted parts of it from African-American folk tradition and invented verses of his own.
One of the things that Emmett's most famous for is his ability to record the purported sounds and rhythms of black speech. Right? So this is a man who made his money arranging and writing songs that would stereotype and in some ways mock African-American speech patterns, African-American culture.
Dixie went viral. And although the North and the South were about to go at each other's throats, whites all over the U.S. loved Dixie. Abraham Lincoln had the song played at his inauguration. When the Confederates were voting on secession, the band played Dixie after each vote in favor. And when Jefferson Davis was inaugurated, the song was arranged to a quickstep beat, something you could sing while marching off to war. And it got lots of new verses.
Southerns, hear ye country call ye, up blessed worse than death before ye. Two arms, in Dixie.
This is a Confederate version. It pledges to live or die for Dixie. It was recreated by a musician named Bobby Horton.
Advance the flag of Dixie, hurrah, hurrah. For Dixie's land, we take our stand and live or die for Dixie.
And the Union had their answer. Again, here's Bobby Horton.
Away down south in the land of traitors, rattlesnakes and alligators, right away, come away, right away, come away. Where cotton's king and men are chattels, Union boys will win the battles, right away, come away.
Each Dixie boy must understand that he must mind his Uncle Sam.
Away, each Dixie boy must understand that he must mind his Uncle Sam. Away.
But that Yankee version didn't stick. A Northerner may have written Dixie, but it perfectly captured the warm sentiment Southerners felt for their homeland, even if they didn't live in cotton country. Dan Emmett,
a union man, was none too pleased.
So he will say on a number of occasions that he wish he'd never written the damn song in the first place, because if he had only known what the Confederates would do with it, if he'd only known what Southerners would claim with his song.
When the bloody war finally came to a close, Lincoln asked the band to play Dixie at victory celebrations. Coleman Hutchison reads the remarks that Lincoln made at one occasion.
"I thought Dixie one of the best tunes I ever heard. I had heard that our adversaries over the way had attempted to appropriate it. I insisted yesterday that we had fairly captured it. I presented the question to the Attorney General, and he gave the opinion that it is our lawful prize. I asked the band to give us a good turn upon it."
It sounds like Lincoln is sticking his vanquished enemies in the eye, but Coleman Hutchison sees it a little differently.
I think he's really reaching out there, yes, to tweak the South a little bit, yes, to acknowledge that the Union had won, but also acknowledging a certain common culture in which the president of the Union, who has just brought to the end the bloodiest war then known to mankind, can also acknowledge an affection for the South and a willingness to work to bring it back together.
But Lincoln was wrong. The North had indeed won the war, but it couldn't claim Dixie. In the Reconstruction era, as Southerners became nostalgic for the antebellum way of life, they got even more attached to Dixie. Confederate heritage organizations decided on a standard version based on Emmett's original verses. But they made one important change. They removed the corny slave dialect, because it wasn't about slave life anymore. It was more about Southern pride. Long into the 20th century, Dixie was popular throughout the nation, sort of like Gone with the Wind. But as the civil rights movement began to make inroads in America, Dixie was a front in a new battle. The Virginia Military Institute is in Lexington, Virginia, situated in the majestic Blue Ridge Mountains. Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee are buried close by.
When you passed Lee's tomb, you were required to salute the flag. And I know the way I got out of that is that I very seldom passed Lee's tomb.
That's Colonel Philip Wilkerson, retired from the U.S. Army.
I attended VMI as one of the first five African-American cadets.
Every May, VMI has a commemoration ceremony for its cadets who died in the Battle of New Market during the Civil War. They helped secure a Confederate victory. For about 100 years, Dixie was a part of that ceremony.
The negative connotation that Dixie held for me, it was associated with the Ku Klux Klan. It was associated with lynching. It was associated with mistreatment of individuals, not only blacks, but Jews and a bunch of that caused conflict within me. Hearing, when I heard the song, music tends to do that, tends to motivate, it stirs the emotion. Those are the emotions that I felt. It caused the conflict.
In 1973, after Wilkerson graduated, the student body voted to eliminate Dixie from the New Market ceremony.
One song does not take away from the valor of those cadets. The student body realized what's more important, playing a old, outdated song or keeping cohesion within the Institute. And I think clearly cohesion within the Institute took precedence.
And this, in the eyes of some, is tantamount to cultural genocide.
People now are denied the use of the song because the politically correct say that it's offensive. It's a form of cultural genocide in that it's stamping out a culture that really is not a threat to anyone.
Glenn McConnell is Lieutenant Governor of South Carolina. When the Citadel, another famous Southern college, stopped playing Dixie at sporting events in the 1990s, McConnell was critical.
If we become intolerant and we start excluding things, we're on a slippery slope. And it eventually erodes that part of history, that part of the culture. racism has occurred north and south and everywhere. And you can't change what occurred, but you can grow from it. And I don't think growing from it is excluding it. Because what happens is when you deny somebody that which they cherish, then that builds up resentment. And that's just not a good way to go. I just think the cement of a free society is toleration and incorporation.
I'm Carol Mosley Braun. In 1993, I was the United States Senator from Illinois.
In 1993, Carol Mosley Braun was the only African American in the United States Senate. She was locked in a power struggle with Jesse Helms over the Confederate flag. It was a technicality having to do with the patent on the flag, but symbolically, it was big. And Mosley Braun was winning the fight against the legendary Jesse Helms.
The next day, I was on the Senate elevator with Senator Hatch and Senator Dodd, and the door opened and Senator Helms started to come onto the elevator, and he said to Orrin Hatch, he said, "I'm going to make her cry. I'm going to sing Dixie until she cries." And I responded, "Senator, you could sing Rock of Ages and I would cry." Did I take it as a jocular kind of, you know, let's be friends? No, it was not. It was intended to be hostile, and it was intended to be aggressive. You know, and I don't mean to speak ill of the dead, because, as you know, he's dead now. But the fact of the matter is that he was part of a cadre of senators who had made a career out of fanning the flames of racial antipathy and antagonism and using that as a way of building their own constituency by exploiting racism.
Can Dixie ever shed that Jesse Helms fanning the flames baggage? The controversy isn't fading. In 2009, the University of Mississippi banned the song. But Coleman Hutchison, the University of Texas historian, thinks that we should be careful about dropping Dixie, even if we find it offensive.
By listening to, by studying Dixie, I think we get an extraordinary opportunity to see the history of the last 150 years, from blackface minstrelsy to the inauguration of Barack Obama. Dixie has been a major cultural thread that can connect those disparate historical moments.
Hutchison thinks that Elvis had the right idea. Yes, Elvis Presley. Elvis began performing a version of Dixie in the early 1970s. But the arrangement, by songwriter Mickey Newberry, gave Dixie a chaser, the battle hymn of the Republic.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Beautiful performances like Elvis's help us to continue to have an ongoing relationship with the song, help us to continue to find a place for it in our lives, our ways of thinking about the U.S. South, about the nation, about slavery, about racism. You know, I wish I could quit you, Dixie. Seems like something that American culture would want to say to this song, but it's not going anywhere.
Amazes me that this argument still has the energy that it does. Americans are still fighting about Southern icons like Dixie and the Confederate flag. The terms of the debate have changed over the years, but there are places where this conflict is still at a fever pitch.
Here on the campus of Washington and Lee University. How you do? And I'm walking up to the Lee Chapel. This is where I was driving to at the beginning of the show, a memorial to the Confederate hero Robert E. Lee. It sits on the campus of Washington and Lee University. Lee was the president of the university after the Civil War. The statue of Lee is in the chapel, and he's lying on his back, draped in a sheet, with his boots on and his legs crossed. When I was last here almost a decade ago, several Confederate battle flags were hoisted on poles around Lee's statue. But after student protests back in 2014, those flags came down. Just a couple of years later, there was another huge change in the town of Lexington. Grace Episcopal Church got its old name back. Robert E. Lee had attended the church back in the 1860s. And after he died, the church was renamed R.E. Lee Memorial Church. But in 2017, parishioners voted to change its name back to Grace Episcopal. And there have been other changes here in Lexington. Right next to Washington and Lee University is the Virginia Military Institute. And for much of VMI's history, cadets had to salute as they walked by memorials that honor Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. But a VMI historian tells me that this custom ended 25 years ago. When I was a kid growing up in West Virginia, we learned about our history, about the split that created our state and the divided loyalties that came along with that. That was all a part of the ambiguity that existed during the Civil War and in the years after. There's a historian I know who says that if they'd taken a vote in some parts of what is now West Virginia, a majority of the citizens would have voted to stay with Virginia and secede from the Union. But this tribute to Robert E. Lee, a Confederate general, reminds me that we see our history differently. And that makes me wonder, where there is pressure to remove these memorials, does it sanitize our history? Or does it help us reflect the values of who we are as citizens today? While history can unite us, it can also break us up. And how we interpret history changes over time. But there's a funny thing about that. While our perception of history is fluid, some of our legacy, well, it's set down in stone. You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this episode is me, Trey Kay, Chris Julin, Catherine Winter, and Kate Smith. Special thanks to Professor James Rahm of Bard College in Annandale, New York, for helping me get my mind around the history of Alexander the Great and Philip II, and to Arsim Zakoli for generously taking time to show me around Skopje and telling me about its history. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. The wonderful people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the CRC Foundation, and the West Virginia Humanities Council. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.